Wisconsin's Department of Trade, Agriculture, and Consumer Protection is your one-stop shop for making sure that you are protected against scammers, thieves, liars, you name it. They want to hear from you. And joining us this hour on the Lee Rayburn Show is Michael Domke. He's the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And we invite you to the show because Michael always learns a thing or two from you and about the latest scams going on. And there is always something new. So you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Michael, welcome back.
Good morning.
I wanted to start today with something that surprised me. It is about that time of year when the leases turn over for many of the college towns around the state of Wisconsin, including where we are in Madison today. And it surprised me to find that the number one consumer complaint that DATCAP receives for the last, 5 years running now?
Correct.
Is tenant-landlord disputes.
It is. It has been
by a margin.
It has been by a margin. Prior to that, telemarketing complaints were our top issue for a couple decades, and then landlord-tenant. And you know, I always like to clarify, and it is not because there is a problem with the industry or that there's a lot of bad landlords that are causing these complaints. It just is we all get used to getting those spam phone calls and those issues, and so we don't want to report them as much as we used to. And
we've gotten used to them.
You know, and we still encourage everyone to let us know about them because it helps us look into it, but it's, you know, we get fatigued. It becomes way of life. You know, you look at your phone, you ignore it, and you don't really pay any more mind to it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that is also why it's been our number one issue.
But this isn't just about tenant or landlords. This is about tenants and landlords. And I'm trying to figure out where the issue is. And I guess from my renting experience, it can be the fine print. It can be the details. It can be the contract that you signed as part of a lease agreement and what those details include or may not include.
It is. It's an understanding of the relationship. And when we talk to landlords and tenants, we say this is a partnership. It's a relationship. And there's both sides have a responsibility. And that really does start with understanding what each side's responsibilities are. And, you know, landlords typically have a firm grasp on what their legal responsibilities are mm-hmm. because they're running a business. And mm-hmm. so they're really invested in it. And tenants, we want to kind of take the same investment because that's where you're coming back to every day. You know, that's where you live. That's where you're going to spend most of your time. And so you don't want that to be kind of a dark cloud that you have to worry about. And it starts with understanding what are the tenant's responsibilities. It's saying, okay, I also play a role here. What is my role? What are the expectations? And there's a lot of factors that go into that tenancy and they really get overlooked, especially when you're getting into it. You know, normally when we hear about it, we think, well, how much is rent? And how long is it for?
Right.
And what's paid for?
And the rest are details that I'll sign without reading. And that could be your danger zone.
It is, because there's so many things. And, you know, we have a list, and I'll just throw some out that, you know, for instance, that people might not always think about. We always talk about utilities, and those are really important because mm-hmm. those are big money issues. And understanding what is the tenant responsible for, because they may think, okay, rent is, you know, $1,000, but your utilities might be another $300. And so that's a third of what you really thought you were going to have to pay. But other little things like guest visits, you know, how often are you allowed to have guests? How long are they able to stay? You know, landlords put those restrictions in place so they don't have additional tenants that bring with them responsibilities for the landlord. So that's a consideration. Is there storage? You know, depending on how big of a space you're renting, is there additional storage available for all the things that you don't have space for? Another is parking. You know, is there parking available?
Yeah.
And if it's not, you know, what are the on-street options? Maybe there's none. Well, you know, you roll in and all of a sudden you find out you have to park 7 blocks away in
January.
Or
pay $100 to $200 a month for the privilege.
Exactly. And another is, you know, what happens when you get locked out? You know, it may happen where you lose your keys or it doesn't work.
I've seen
so
it. Yeah.
How long, how much does it cost for a lockout? Some of those can be expensive. And, you know, the last one here is maintenance. You know, how do you submit a request for maintenance? And this is important because, you know, landlords are required to let the tenant know how to do so, but the tenant needs to realize here's what the step is and here's what the expectations are when something goes wrong.
And the landlord needs to know when something goes wrong. I mean, they're not there. It's the responsibility of the tenant to actually notify the landlord because they're the one responsible for immediate upkeep. They're the ones that have to let everybody know. And if they don't, there could be a liability issue there.
Oh, You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we kind of dispel that perception that, well, this isn't my place, so I don't have to worry about it. Well, kind of you do. You inherit some of that responsibility of that day-to-day upkeep, but also notifying the landlord when something is wrong. So if, a small leak and you're thinking, well, let's throw a pan underneath it. Well, that small leak grows and then maybe there's mold and it's something that was preventative. Well, the tenant also inherits some of that responsibility.
But is it this time of year around the move-in time, move-out time, where you find the greatest disputes, or are these happening year-round?
The disputes are happening year-round.
Okay.
And so we're seeing this is often our number one complaint each month and then in total every year. But we see the types of landlord-tenant complaints. Those will have some spikes. For instance, security deposit returns.
Oh, yeah.
Often an issue, but when we see it in like the August or maybe June, when you see those typical higher volume move out times, mm-hmm. we'll see security deposit complaints rise. Other things with, say, maintenance issues having to do with, say, heat. Well, we'll see those rise when the months start to get cold because, say, you move in August. Say you move in right now.
Yeah.
We're not going to turn the heat on.
No.
We're not going to turn the heat on.
You're not going to find out until like November.
Right.
Maybe October.
So our heating complaints will rise. And so there's ebbs and flows depending on the type of complaint we get.
But I think the big issue would be upkeep from both sides. As the landlords are running a business, there may be margins. It's not cheap to, home remodeling is not cheap right now. And then there's the responsibility of the tenant to upkeep the home. And I think sometimes I hear it described as a rental car, as you kind of drive it into the ground and then walk away from it like you didn't have any responsibility for it. So I would feel like there is a gap that needs to be bridged in those two things, that everybody's responsible for the upkeep, and it does matter how you leave it once you're done with it, and there is a responsibility of the landlords to take care of it, and that cost needs to be factored into the rent when the contract is signed.
All of those are true. And also, I want to kind of remind everyone or anyone who's listening who is a renter that security deposit is really a protection for the landlord, but also for you in a sense that when you have a security deposit, it triggers the requirement that you have 7 days to do an initial inspection. And we encourage every tenant when they're initially moving in to please complete that checkout
sheet. Take pictures,
document any issues that you see or concerns. So that if there was something that maybe the landlord missed mm-hmm. when they were having that turning the place over and renting it to a new tenant, that they have an opportunity to repair that. Or if it doesn't get repaired and it's time for you to move out, that the tenant doesn't get charged for that. But that security deposit also isn't kind of a cap and a limitation. And sometimes tenants think, well, my security deposit's only
$500. It's the most I'm going to have to pay.
Exactly. And that's not true. So we don't want
to. So if you trash the joint, you could be ending up paying for that joint.
You most likely will end up paying for that joint.
Wow.
Correct.
Is the security deposit, does that get interest while the landlord holds it, or is that depend on the contract? Do you know?
The landlord just holds it. And so how they hold it, there's no law under debt cap authority that dictates what they do with that money. It's just that money is there in place to compensate for any particular damages that occur during the tenancy.
And is there a general rule of where debt cap can intercede and the things that, are beyond your control with consumer protection?
Well, we have there's a state statute and there's an administrative rule that specify the particular things that debt cap has authority over.
Right.
And so, those have to do mostly are governed around leading up to the tenancy and then after the tenancy.
Okay.
So during the tenancy, it's limited. We have a little bit, but it's more of about the lease itself, what representations are made about the property, what disclosures are made, what is the condition of the property when they're moving in, mm-hmm. the actual paperwork. And then after they move out, the return of that security deposit, where those charges or deductions proper. So that's where we're in the middle. And also evictions, we don't have authority over evictions. So we get a lot of complaints about that, but that is outside of our scope.
And just to make clear, the consumer protection for debt cap, that comes from the state statutes. That comes from the state legislature signed by the governor and the administrative rules that interpret what those state statutes mean. You don't get to decide what consumer protection means. You just have to adhere to what the government, what the state decides as a government. And as an extension, we have some say in that as well.
That is correct. Consumer protection, I would say, look at it as a general umbrella term that covers a wide variety of different consumer issues. And then underneath that umbrella are specific laws and rules that kind of pinpoint what particular area we can help out with.
And you don't get to decide those things.
We do not decide those things.
Michael Domke, our guest, director of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Lisbeth, as Lisbeth in Wyoega did, she emailed to say she receives as many as 3 calls a day, each from a different number, that want her to check their Google Business Directory listing. When this first started, Elizabeth actually thought it was a legitimate mistake and would ask to speak with someone, and she received reassurances that her name would be removed from their list. Elizabeth now says it is obvious that this is a scam, since it happens every day, day after day, week after week, month after month, each time, again, coming from a different number. What can Elizabeth do to make these phone calls stop?
So if I understand, they're calling in regards to Elizabeth's business.
They want, They want us to check our Google Business Directory listing. So they probably found him on Google as a business.
Correct.
And then they got on a list, and then everybody called him.
Correct. The unfortunate part is, because of that public listing, it makes it easier for these scammers to identify who they want to reach out to. And then they also will tailor those particular approaches based on the fact that it is a business. Mm. And so the one that Elizabeth mentioned is confirming that information. What will likely happen with those calls, if they continue and she has the conversation, is they're going to try and get more details about the business or offer promotional opportunities on how to better market it. And with those, we'll bring a payment method. And mm-hmm. So then they'll ask for, how do we pay for these? The other challenge there is, if the best advice for Elizabeth is to not answer any of those calls. Now, it's easy for me to sit here and say that because I don't own a business.
Right. As an individual, you can ignore all the calls Correct. That don't come up as a contact. But as a business, you're kind of dependent on those calls coming in, regardless of where they're coming from.
Correct. And the other challenge to that is, oftentimes when we are talking about this particular topic, you know, we encourage the do not call registry, but that doesn't apply to businesses. Mm. And so it's not that Elizabeth could put that number on there either. It's really kind of a tough situation where Elizabeth's just going to have to be really diligent in navigating and identifying what might be a legitimate call and what isn't, and then making sure she can filter through those.
It's stories like these that make me want to find creative ways to scam the scammer. And I don't know if that would end up with me in the crosshairs of the dad cap, but I'd want to try to find a way to fight back. I feel like they've got the upper hand, especially for businesses who can't go on the no-call list, who rely on those calls who are not their contacts to be new contacts, new business, and opportunities.
Yeah, I would say if there is any of these conversations, any of these particular, we'll say marketers mm-hmm. or scammers identify a business that they're with or a particular area that they're calling from, and she wants to report that to us, we can try and look into that a little bit. I will say it's limited on where our authority will land.
Sure.
But if there's a pattern of those, and we see, because there are situations where we see scammers or we'll say unscrupulous businesses that will reach out to businesses, target them for, say, required business filings, and tell them, hey, you're required to submit this particular document to a state agency, and we'll do it on your behalf for X amount of dollars. And they're charging much more than what that filing is. Sometimes it's free. Now, it doesn't mean that that practice is necessarily illegal, but the deceptive ways in which they try and coerce or convince businesses to do it is illegal.
Yeah.
And so depending on what they're saying to Elizabeth or how they're marketing to her, there may be some area for us to help, but it is also a tough area to say, okay, this is exactly what we can do. You also mentioned something interesting about scamming the scammers, and we hear about this when we do our outreach presentations, and often there's an audience member that says, I want to get them back, or I want to do something.
Yeah,
and
I feel that.
And I recognize it. I do. You know, and they say, I stay on the phone, I'm going to waste their time because, you know, then they can't call somebody else. And granted, there may be some self-satisfaction that comes with that. The risks that come with that are the questions that are being asked are often, it's called social engineering. And so they're doing is they're asking you questions that you don't even realize are important. If someone were to ask you, what's your social security number, your bank account, your Medicare number?
We're all like, red okay, flags.
All red flags.
Yes.
But if they're asking you, well, what street did you live up on? Or you start talking about pets and what was your pet's
name? Those are my security questions.
Those are your security questions. And so through these conversations, they're building a profile about you that you don't even realize or don't think is important. But in reality, it is. The second thing it does is it tells, they sell these lists and they tell others, hey, Lee answers the phone. Lee talked to me for 20 minutes. I'm going to sell Lee's name to all these other people because they know Lee will talk.
So that's part of the business too, is just figuring out who will engage and letting everybody else know for a fee that these folks are engageable.
That's it. And when you hear stories about Elizabeth and maybe their different approaches, we hear about scammers and they'll try all different things. So say they call Elizabeth and say, hey, we've got a great deal on these new billboards.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth doesn't respond. They'll throw that away and they'll say, okay, well, Elizabeth isn't interested in billboards.
Yeah.
Hey, Elizabeth, we've got a great deal on off-street marketing. We put signs on telephone poles for you. She doesn't respond. They throw that away. And they keep going through different approaches until they hit one. So if you engage, it makes it even more overwhelming.
I was thinking more of an air horn, but I'll stay... I will rely on DadCap for that. Because that's the sort of in my head anger that I get from things like this that are monopolizing our time, trying to take advantage of us, trying to figure out a way to squirrel a few bucks, if not more, from us. What's the best way to get a hold of DadCap if Elizabeth wants to follow up here?
Two ways. First, you can call our consumer protection hotline at 1-800-422-7128, or you can visit us online at datcp.wy.gov.
Easy enough. 800-422-7128 or datcp.wy.gov. Ellie in Middleton emailed to say she's a homeowner thinking about bringing in a roommate. She's having trouble finding resources online for what rules and processes she'd need to be aware of. How can she protect herself? Do you have resource recommendations?
Indeed we do, and
yes.
I'm glad Ellie reached out. So on our website that we just mentioned, datcp.wy.gov, we have our landlord-tenant guide. And this is a comprehensive guide that benefits both landlords and tenants that breaks down the rules and the law into a better, more consumable way to understand what those rights and responsibilities are of both sides. And so for Ellie, the one thing I would encourage that she understand is if she's bringing in a roommate, if she is going to have that roommate pay anything, not necessarily just rent to Ellie, but mm-hmm. if that roommate's responsible for the utilities mm-hmm. or that roommate's going to be responsible for paying for the meals, that is a form of compensation which makes Ellie a landlord. We also want to keep in mind that, say you have a rental situation, maybe Ellie's renting. Well, now if Ellie's bringing in a roommate or a friend and they're paying compensation to Ellie, now she's subletting. And so it's really great that Ellie's reaching out to understand what are her responsibilities in that arena. Take a look at our landlord-tenant guide, understand what that means. And then if she has more questions, she can either call us or there's a lot of really, really great landlord associations throughout Wisconsin that will be more than happy to help her out.
I'm just thinking if money changes hands and it has to do with residency to any degree in any way, that there should be some sort of lease agreement or contract signed in order to hold both parties accountable if it were to ever come to that.
Always.
Handshake agreements aren't going to cut it if things fall apart.
Correct. And it's a great point. While verbal agreements are legally binding in Wisconsin, they are. So if you and I decided, hey, we were going to be roommates and you were at the property and you tell me, just pay me, you know, $100 a week, that's a legally binding agreement. You've become a landlord at that point.
Well, then I'm going to tell you I didn't say that.
And that's going to make it difficult when things go sideways and fall apart.
Which makes the whole legal verbal agreements questionable, because when it comes down to, unless you have a notary, I guess, who is there to observe the verbal agreement, but that's kind of like a contract itself.
It is. And we always encourage everyone, please you know, please make sure that you are documenting as much as you can. Now, what's interesting that we mentioned, Wisconsin, once you accept that money or you take payment, mm-hmm. it does require you to execute a written agreement.
Okay.
And so there is all that. Right. But once it's that initial agreement through that verbal conversation that can all of a sudden put you in a situation you didn't realize you were in. And also you mentioned that money, we always like to emphasize that it's compensation of any kind. It doesn't mean just money.
So barter and trade would count in that as well?
If it's a form of compensation that benefits the property owner, yes.
I'm just feeling very fortunate. When I lived in upstate New York, I lived in the basement of a log cabin with a handshake agreement and got away with it. I mean, I covered my share and I was happy to take care of the place. It was beautiful. It was back in Freeville, New York, the only Freeville in the world. And so it was back up on a beautiful plot of land. And yeah, and it was in the basement of a log cabin. I really loved being there, but it was... There was no paperwork at all involved, and when the time came to move, I think we both, it was kind of sad, but I just feel very lucky now. Not even fortunate, just like that roll of the dice, thanks to Larry the landlord, you know, worked out for both of us.
To your point there, it's about the relationship, right?
Yes.
You know, that handshake agreement worked out because you had a communication, you had a good relationship, you upheld your end of the deal, you know, you paid what you're supposed to, you didn't. You know, wreck the place, let them know. And that's why those things can still work. I imagine there's going to be several listeners right now that reflect back to maybe when they were younger and had somebody stay with them, or maybe even now are realizing, I was probably a landlord at one point and didn't even realize it.
And were you a landlord too? Carl and Ashland emailed to say he is a landlord and one of his tenants has found bed bugs. He wants to know who's financially responsible for the cost of treating for them when it was the fault of the tenant. He says when it was the fault of the tenant. So there seems to be a lot. The tenant is responsible for this. Does the landlord have to pay?
So I want to clarify that DADCAP does not have any authority over a situation dealing with bed bugs. We do mention it briefly in our landlord tenant guide, but we refer individuals to the Department of Health Services.
Okay.
So as far as who is financially responsible for remediating that issue, that really comes down to a business between the landlord and that tenant and whether or not they can find a mechanism in which they decided that, yes, you are held accountable for that, but there is no specific rule under DECAP authority that addresses it.
I would also think it would be difficult to prove who brought the bed bugs in.
We get these complaints quite often.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Typically from tenants who move into multi-unit buildings and then move in and within like a week have bed bugs, and that is because, you know, the bed bugs don't often stay just in one unit.
Mm-hmm.
They spread maybe throughout the building, and so then it's also difficult to identify, well, where did they start? If it's just a single unit or residence, clearly it's a little bit more easy to say, okay, they probably originated here because you're the only family or individual living. But in multifamily, it's more challenging.
So for Carl, Department of Health Services for more?
It can. And also there, you know, we've seen lease agreements where they specify, all right, you know, if this is an issue like pest control or pest remediation, can, if it's clarified in the lease, can be a tenant's responsibility.
So it might be there in the fine print.
I have to look.
You ever use artificial intelligence to run contracts or agreements? Because I don't read those when I sign them like I should. I know this. I'm well aware. So I wonder if maybe an AI could help, you know, suss it out for me, tell me the important details. But then again, with things like AI hallucinations, they could come up with stuff that's not even in there and skip the important stuff altogether. I think it's probably best to read it yourself. At what point would you incorporate legal help in any of this?
Well, we mentioned earlier, especially with Carl being a landlord, I would reach out to see if there's a landlord association in his area. There's a statewide landlord association. Mm-hmm. That would be a great resource for him to reach. And I know that they would have answers and resources for him on this particular issue.
Michael Domke, our guest, he's the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And we've been talking about tenant-landlord issues because that is by far by twice as many as telemarketers, their number one complaint. But you probably have some of your own, and you're welcome to the show at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our conversation about consumer protection continues next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. The hotline for the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is 1-800-422-7128. That's 800-422-7128 if you have a consumer complaint. You can also visit their website at datcp.wi.gov. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest this hour is Michael Domke, director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection, and we're taking your complaints, your questions, your stories that may help others at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Dennis in Oshkosh. Dennis, hi.
Yes, hi, Lee and Michael. This may be out of the area, but I'll try. Maybe you can give me some direction. A grandson going to Edgewood College just rented an apartment, as most of them do. And the thing he signed and the advertisement said it was air-conditioned. And we were there loading and unloading on an 85-degree day a couple weeks ago. There is no air conditioning.
Oh, but it's in the written agreement. It was in the advertisement that was marketing this apartment in Madison. So I would imagine there could be some recourse for Dennis and his grandson, Michael.
Absolutely. I'm glad Dennis reached out. This is something we can help with. If that was marketed as having an amenity, and in fact, when you got in there, it did not have the amenity that you agreed to and that they had promoted, and that was what the agreement also included as air conditioning, yes, we can help with that.
1-800-422-7128. Dennis, I do believe that is your next call, and thank you for calling us. Let's go to Kathleen in Oregon next. Kathleen, hi.
Hi there. I work for a business who got a call from a very irate person recently, and I don't blame him. He said that his son's phone got 24 calls within the last few days from our number, and nobody has called them. They're not customers of ours. And I'm thinking that it's probably, you know, a scam or some other business disguising their, you know, what pops up on caller ID with our number. And I'm just wondering what kind of, are there services where we can contact somebody or a service where we can have that, have our number more secure, more protected, that doesn't happen?
So wait a minute, Kathleen, somebody was calling and your number, your business number was coming up and they were making like a couple dozen calls to one person under your business number?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that legal to go ahead and use somebody else's phone number to come up in a caller ID like that? That feels like it should be against something.
It is not legal. There is a specific law that prohibits that. There's actually two different laws. One from disguising the phone number in general. The second is disguising a phone number during a marketing call. So two separate laws that make that illegal. I don't know of any tools that would help protect that particular phone number. And I don't know that would even be possible because what we're talking about here is called spoofing. And spoofing is disguising or manipulating the number that displays when it shows up on a phone. And we know that scammers do this all the time, and it's very, very easy to do. The software is cheap, and you and I could download an app and, you know, do it right now. And
wow.
So I don't think that it would, I don't know of any software, so I can't say that it's not out there, but I think it would be very challenging for that to be successful.
So is spoofing, it's illegal.
It is.
The software is not.
Correct.
Well, that seems to be a loophole that you could drive a cell phone through.
Well, it's yes, but it also, I think there's a lot of things that are not illegal, but in the manner in which they're used, they
yes.
become illegal.
So how would you go about identifying this person who is spoofing Kathleen's business's phone number? How do you even find them?
So it is difficult to do. If we get the phone number, there are some tools that help us kind of look at the origin of where the number came from. But if all we're given is that actual front-facing phone number and we're not able to identify, you know, some the details behind it, it does become challenging.
So if Kathleen submitted to DATCAP her business number and the number that that business number allegedly called 24 times, there could be a trail to follow?
It would be difficult
okay.
if she submitted, because when we look at where that phone number is registered to, it's going to be Kathleen's business.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's tough to track these scammers down, because we don't know who's behind it and what number is being used. This is why you hear people from time to time say that their own phone number called them.
Yes.
And it's because scammers use just random generators to create a number that will display when they call. That's also why we hear particular, you know, I was called 17 times from 17 different phone numbers.
Yeah, like Lisbeth and Wyawiga at the
Correct.
Start of the show.
Correct. It's because they're just randomly generating numbers.
But it's the same number. I feel like you should have some software that could figure out a way through the wires to get back to the source.
If it would take identifying the particular individual's phone records.
I feel like this is a job for the NSA, not DATCAP.
You're getting into a level of detail that I'm not sure a lot would want to be comfortable doing.
Understood. Kathleen, I wish we could help more, and not just for you, but for everybody like Elizabeth and Wyawiga. This seems to be a running common problem. And if you've had it too, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. And Kathleen, thank you very much for the call. I'm sure you're not alone. Dan in Menominee, you're next. Hello.
Hi. So I'm about to become a landlord. I own my own home, and it has a couple of spare rooms, which I'm going to rent out here in about 3 weeks. I have tried to find written rental agreements and found dozens that claim to be binding and claim to be simple, but I really don't know who to trust here. Hmm. Is there a single source?
So DATCAP does not provide nor approve any specific lease agreements and say that this is one that is guaranteed. However, I will say that there are some very reputable organizations, if you were to look at landlord associations here in Wisconsin, that do offer services and provide leases. And I would just encourage Dan to seek out one of those well-established, well-known organizations, contact them, and they can point you in the right direction for a lease that is most likely compliant.
I wonder to what degree investing in an attorney as a landlord is a valuable resource and worth the money.
I think if you're just starting out, in Dan's case, you know, taking a little bit of that initiative to reach out to an attorney on the front end and say, this is one of the agreements I want to use. Yeah. Does it comply with Chapter 704 and our administrative rules? And then on the front end, and then you have one that you know is well established, mm-hmm. I think that would be worth the investment.
Dan, so a landlord association in your area, or perhaps an attorney that knows real estate law. And thank you for the call. Susan in La Crosse, you're next. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. I am involved in a situation with an elderly gentleman who is hook, line, sinker involved in a catfishing scheme. Things have been locked down. He's been talked to by a fraud officer at the bank who have told him he is not sending money to a celebrity for their medical bills. And he is refusing to believe this and appears to be running himself into extreme debt. I'm just wondering what suggestions your guest may have to assist here. Honestly, I've got an appointment with an attorney tomorrow to see what options. I'm just timely show for this kind of situation. I'm just curious to see what Michael may suggest.
Susan, it's heartbreaking, and I wish this was the only time I've ever heard this story, but unfortunately, we hear this quite a bit, and especially is in, tied up with the situations where maybe it's a romance scam or someone who is emotionally invested in that situation, and it becomes very difficult to get past that emotional barrier they build up because they don't want it to be false. They want it to be true, and makes it even more difficult. To answer Susan's question, you know, we've found that trying to get as many different sources who are typically respectable and they would recognize or maybe appreciate their opinion to explain how they've experienced this in the past, that would start with maybe having somebody, if he's able to talk to somebody on our hotline from DadCap, and we would be able to explain, we hear about this situation every day. I would contact local law enforcement and have a police officer explain. They deal with this all the time. They're very well acquainted with this. And then maybe a local ADRC, Aging Disability Resource Centers. Every county has one. They're very well versed in these types of scams. I share these as particular resources that we found individuals, if they see someone who's established, has experience with this, and can tell the same story from other individuals, it helps them maybe break out a little bit and see that their situation isn't unique, that it isn't a one-off, that this happens a lot. So, Susan, my best advice is to try and find as many different resources who are willing to come and talk to this gentleman to hopefully get through that.
So DATCAP at 1-800-422-7128. The La Crosse Police Department can have somebody who will help, and your local ADRC as well. And it sounds kind of like an intervention with all hands on deck. And the more people that speak to this gentleman, the more likely you are to break that connection. But Michael, you talked about social engineering before, and this to me just screams social engineering. They get your hooks in you. They make you believe, and the more you believe, the harder it is to drop it.
All of it. And the more that they establish that relationship and build that trust and have their victims convinced that it's real and this is where it's going, it also is they go to great lengths to explain how others are going to try and tell them that it's not true. They try and get in front of what we're doing right now and saying, you know, the law enforcement is going to stop by and tell you this isn't real, but it is. You know, they're going to tell you that there's other situations. And yes, there are scammers that do that, but this one's different. This one is real. And so they try and get in front of how they know we're going to try and combat that so that it makes it even more difficult to break through. I will say the La Crosse Police Department, I know firsthand that they have an incredible officer and a detective that are very well versed in this and would be great resources to go talk to.
Susan, I am so sorry and at the same time kind of angry. And I thank you for the call, and I hope this helps others, and I hope you find help with your catfishing scheme. It's just horrendous. I want to talk about another scam that's coming up here. It's almost an annual event these days. Medicare open enrollment begins October 15th, and there are some things folks should know before they begin. And they're pretty basic, and if they keep them in mind as open enrollment gets underway, I think you can keep yourself safe.
It is. So Medicare open enrollment, we kind of talk about the big spike of the year. But Medicare scams continue to be in the top three calls that we get every single month. Now, just here in September, October, November, that is a giant spike. A few things we want everyone, and these are kind of like your basic foundational understandings that will hopefully help deter most of these scammers. The first is that the real Medicare is never going to call or visit a consumer at home to try and sell a product. Medicare may explain what options are out there, especially if you call them, but they're not going to call looking to solicit and sell you any of these products.
They'll never come to your door, and they'll never ring your phone.
They will not. Not to sell you a product.
Easy.
Easy. Next is that we want everyone to treat their Medicare number as if it is their Social Security number, as if it's their credit card number, their bank account number, because it has just as much value. Sometimes we hear about those other big ones and we think that that's the most valuable piece of information out there, and it's not really the case, especially for Medicare beneficiaries. That number is incredibly valuable, so please don't share with anyone unless you have initiated that contact, unless you're the one that has called Medicare, you're the one that's called an organization to help you out and maybe get you enrolled in another plan. The next is that Medicare cards don't need to be replaced We get these calls if they're, you know, unless they're lost or stolen, but if it's a matter of, hey, your Medicare card expired, or we're now issuing plastic cards instead of paper cards. Not true. We saw the plastic card scam really spike last year, where they were saying we're no longer issuing paper cards and you have to give us your number and confirm this information to get a plastic
card. How are they being
card.
Notified for those?
They're calling.
They're calling. That's not coming in the mail. Okay.
No, they're just calling and saying, hey, it's expired, it's outdated. That also is not true. The Medicare card that you get is the one that you can hang on to.
For life.
Correct. Okay. And then last is, you know, Medicare enrollees, that just if you're going to go to the website and you want to do some research, you're thinking about what options or plans that you might be switching to, just making sure that you're the one that's typing in the website address, that you're not responding to a text message or an email or a link or that a phone call saying, hey, you need to go here. We really need everyone to understand of how important it is to control that flow of communication, that you're the one initiating the contact. You can trust it if you're the one that is reaching out. You need to be suspicious on anything that's coming in.
Some easy but important reminders for Medicare open enrollment that can protect you from our guest, Michael Donkey, director of DADCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And there's still time for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Mabel in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Mabel.
Hello. This lady was talking about this person sending money to someone and it was a scam. And they can't get them to stop. She did not say how they're sending this money, but if they're using the U.S. mail, you can contact the Postal Inspection Service, and they can do a lot of checking for you. And they are the police of the post office.
So Mabel is absolutely correct, and I love that she brought this up because it gives us an opportunity to really talk about a couple other areas on how we hear about these victims paying money, and there are several avenues in which that money can be recovered. Mabel perfectly pointed out the Postal Service. So if you are mailing cash or mailing a check and you realize that, hey, I believe this may not have been under the best of intentions, calling the Postal Service, they will intercept that package before it's delivered and make sure it gets returned to you. So that's one way.
Wow.
Another is we talk about, the most common is cryptocurrency. And we hear about cryptocurrency being sent, and there's a couple different ways that happens. Most commonly we're seeing with these is those kiosks that you see in retail locations throughout Wisconsin. And there was a law that was passed earlier this year that provided a lot of protections for consumers who may have used those in response to a scammer calling and saying, this is how you need to pay me. And that law provided some opportunities for consumers to recover that money. It's very important that they recognize they need to file a notice with the kiosk operator and the Department of Justice, local law enforcement, or the Department of Financial Institutions within 30 days. And I really want to emphasize that because it's an incredible tool that didn't exist before.
Right.
Before, you'd put that money in there, and for the most part, it was gone. And now you have a great opportunity to try and recover that.
But it's a 30-day window.
It's a 30-day window, and you must file with those two. There's more information on our website and also the Department of Financial Institutions on how to do it. And another, if I could mention, is gift cards. We always hear about gift cards being sent, right? If you do buy a gift card and you give that money over or you send it, you know, we talked about the mail, but if you give those numbers on the back and you realize I probably shouldn't have done that, if you call that vendor right away, they have the opportunity to freeze that card, freeze those funds, and then put them onto a different card for you.
Same way you could freeze a credit card.
Same way. But it's timing. And all of these, timing is of the essence. Because with that gift card, if you give the number over, the scammer might take it. But I would encourage everyone, visit our website, because we list all of these out. We list exactly how you should, the steps you should take to try and recover that money, who you need to call, how you need to do it. And it gives you the best option to say, all right, how did I pay? Mabel perfectly laid it out. There's all these options. But understand how you can try and recover it.
DATCP.WI.gov or 1-800-422-7128. And along with our list of DATCAP, the local police, the local ADRC, we're adding the Postal Inspection Service to this list today, thanks to Mabel, who is now our new consumer protection expert. So thank you so much for calling, Mabel. Happy to add it to the list. Let's go to Doug in Colfax next. Doug, hi.
Hello. I have a question about leases. I'm a landlord. I have used in the past successfully a Wisconsin Real Estate Association lease And I believe that works fine. But my question specifically is about DocuSign. I live about 50 miles away from one of my rentals, and I send leases that way. And sometimes I see that the tenant gets it, but they don't sign it and send it back. Is that still a binding agreement?
The law requires that both parties sign that agreement. It doesn't specify how that agreement gets signed. So to answer Doug's question, both parties need to sign it.
But they can use DocuSign or some, it doesn't have to be a verifiable signature. I just did this at the doctor's office the other day with accepting all the different things you have to do when you go in and it signs your name for you. I'm like, that's not my signature. It looks nothing like that. That's too beautiful to be my signature, but it is a binding signature nonetheless.
If you affirmed it, that is correct.
So Doug just sending it out does not mean that that is in any way a binding contract or rental agreement.
Both parties need to sign. That is correct.
Is there a window in which they need to sign it?
No, not in the Wisconsin law.
But Doug, get that signed to protect yourself. And until then, it's not binding. And thank you for calling. Daryl emailed, his daughter is interested in subletting her apartment next summer. What are her responsibilities for any damage or general chaos a subletter could do? Throwing a party or two, perhaps?
All of the damage can be responsible for the tenant. So the
daughter rents an apartment, looking to sublet it next summer, wants to know what she should be looking out for.
First, she should make sure that her lease allows for subletting. Many leases don't allow subletting. And so the first is to, if that isn't in the lease, to reach out to the landlord and see if that's an option. If it is allowed, then what she needs to do is be very careful on that agreement between her and the subletter to specify who's going to be responsible for those damages. But what that does not absolve her of the responsibility. You kind of have two tiers where they are into the damage, but she still has the responsibility under her agreement to that landlord.
So if she has a written agreement with the subletter, does that, as long as it's permitted by her landlord, is that...
They both carry the responsibility at that point.
Okay, and you would want to some written agreement with... I think my first summer in Madison, I had a handshake sublet. So I just feel like I've been getting away with it this whole time, Michael.
Sounds like you have.
I know. But on the other, I don't think I've made it any worse for the wear for anybody. At least I hope not. One of the worst scams I've seen with a couple minutes we have left here is the one that seems to be going after descendants of Holocaust victims. And this, again, I just want to get my air horn out. That's, I am... I don't even have words for stories like these. And yet when they come into your Consumer Protection Bureau, you got to deal with them.
It is. It just shows that there's no level of depravity that they will ignore.
Yeah.
And they're going to seek any opportunity to take advantage of individuals that they can. And they'll cast that wide net. Or in these cases, they're going to target specific groups. Mm. This one in particular is we received a complaint and a report where the scammer sent the letter to the descendant of a Holocaust survivor that claimed to represent an organization called the Holocaust Survivors Compensation Program, and they were associated with the Jewish Holocaust Claims Center, or JHCC. However, neither one of those organizations really exist. Now, the letter was very well written, appeared to be official, and said that due to some international agreements that eligible victims and their descendants could receive compensation from the German government. And I just lay that foundation because after that, kind of the practice then goes into what we normally see with these letters.
Send us money to get money?
Correct. You want the personal information, locking in, identifying who they are, verifying their identity that, in fact, they are the descendant. And then saying at that point, where would you like these funds sent? Or there's going to be some particular fee for the organization that recovered the money for them and they need to pay it up front. We really want to highlight that, you know, be aware. And understand also the takeaway here is what this particular family, in fact, was the descendant of a Holocaust victim. Mm-hmm. And so if you're asking yourself or saying, well, this maybe might be real because how else would they know what's me?
Right.
Like, how would they know?
They already
this?
Know something about me.
Correct. There is they know too much about me for this to be a scam. And that's where we want to make sure people don't give into that, that they fight that belief or that urge, that they go past that and say, I still need to look into this. Or the fact that they say no scammer would ever do this. Like, this is so unconscionable that they wouldn't do this. Is get past that and verify and trust everything. And thankfully, this individual who got the letter said, I'm going to double check.
Yeah.
And through their internet search, they realized that this scam had been perpetrated across the country. Same letter, same organization. And of course, that stopped them from responding. But we were emphasizing that emotional reaction to, it seems real. They know enough about me. And this is where social engineering comes into place and why they identify who they are and saying, don't give in to your gut.
I think that my takeaway from this is not only is there, you know, pure evil out there, but there is also, do not underestimate how much information about you exists out there and that they can glean from you and then target you through this social engineering. Stay cynical, but really stay skeptical. And when the time comes, let the Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection's Bureau of Consumer Protection know at 1-800-422-7128 or datcp.wi.gov. Michael, I think we did some good today. Thank you very much for your heavy lift.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Domke, Director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.